would like to begin this morning by reading one of this month's lectionary texts, the parable of the wedding banquet from the 22nd chapter of Matthew. Once more, Jesus spoke to them in parables, saying, "The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding banquet for his son. He sent his slaves to call those who had been invited to the wedding banquet, but they would not come. Again, he sent other slaves, saying, 'Tell those who have been invited, look, I have prepared my dinner. My oxen and my fat calves have been slaughtered, and everything is ready. Come to the wedding banquet.' But they made light of it and went away, one to his farm, another to his business, while the rest seized his slaves, mistreated them, and killed them. The king was enraged. He sent his troops, destroyed those murderers, and burnt their city. Then he said to his slaves, 'The wedding is ready, but those who were invited are not worthy. Go therefore into the main streets and invite everyone you find to the wedding banquet.' Those slaves went out into the streets and gathered all whom they found, both good and bad. So the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see his guests, he noticed a man there who was not wearing a wedding robe. And he said to him, 'Friend, how did you get in here without a wedding robe?' And he was speechless. Then the king said to his attendants, 'Bind him hand and foot, and throw him out into the outer darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. For many are called, but few are chosen.'" Here ends this reading of Scripture. May God keep our hearts and minds open and honest as we search for its truth. There are five sources we may turn to when we want to discover the words Jesus spoke when he walked among us. These are the four traditional Gospels: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and the Gospel of Thomas, which archaeologists uncovered in 1945. Each of these five sources provides a slightly different slant to the words of Jesus, all of them having been written at least 40 years after Jesus was crucified. Some stories and sayings are found in only one of these accounts. For example, only the Gospel of John provides an account of Jesus turning water into wine. Only Matthew's gospel has wise men visiting the infant Jesus. Only Luke's gospel has Jesus teaching men in the synagogue when he was only 12 years old. Other stories and sayings are found in more than one of the sources, although frequently in different forms. As for the sayings of Jesus, scholars tend to believe that the more sources that reveal the same saying, the more likely it is Jesus actually said it. This is especially true if it's found in more than one of the biblical gospels, and also in the Gospel of Thomas, which is basically a list of sayings of Jesus. This story of the wedding banquet is found in three accounts: Matthew, Luke, and Thomas. And so while many of the words attributed to Jesus were probably placed there by the writers of the Gospels and probably were not spoken by Jesus himself, it is the general consensus of scholars that Jesus did indeed tell a story in the form of a parable about a great banquet. So this is definitely a story worth examining. That's the good news. The bad news is that of the three versions of the parable, Matthew's version, which we heard this morning, is probably the furthest away from the way Jesus actually told the story. Now, I know some people are going to say I'm being nitpicky or that I'm just picking the Bible apart, but that honestly is not my intention. Like most of you, I recognize that Jesus of Nazareth was the central figure in human history. And I want to know, as precisely as we can possibly determine, exactly what words actually came from his mouth. That's very important to me, considering I often refer to him as the Son of God. the fact that Matthew shaped the words of Jesus to fit the message Matthew was desperately trying to convey to his community does not bother me a bit. And it tells us important things about the social and political world in which Matthew lived. Before we look at how Matthew's version of this story differs from the way Luke and Thomas tell the story, let's examine Matthew's version. This parable is a straightforward allegory. Sometimes the parables are mysterious, and they make you scratch your head and wonder, what message are we supposed to be getting here? But this one is basically a straightforward allegory where everything stands for something else. The king who throws the banquet, that is God. The son who is the focus of the celebration, that is Jesus. The banquet itself is the church. The slaves who go and tell the invited guests it's time for the wedding, those are the apostles and the evangelists spreading the gospel of Jesus. The invited guests who refuse to come to the banquet, those are those first century Jews who wouldn't believe in Jesus. The uninvited guests who the slaves bring to the banquet in place of the invited guests, those are the Gentiles, the non-Jewish people who do respond to the gospel. That is Matthew's story, and it appears Matthew made two major changes to the story Jesus told. In the other accounts of this parable, after the slaves return to the king and tell him the invited guests are too busy to come to the banquet, the king instantly orders the slaves to go out into the streets and invite anyone they find. Matthew inserts into the story the part about the invited guests seizing and killing the slaves, and has the king send his troops to destroy the murderers and burn their cities. What does this tell us? Why did Matthew add that? Well, it's safe to say that Matthew's community had received some pretty rough treatment in their efforts to spread the gospel, and his addition to the parable is a reflection of the treatment his community had received. The second change Matthew seems to have made to the story Jesus actually told is found in its ending. He tacks on the part about the king noticing a guest not wearing a wedding robe and ordering him out of the banquet into the outer darkness where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Matthew further adds that many are called, but few are chosen. And while the first insert was an attack on the Jews who refused to believe in Jesus, the second addition is an attack on the Gentiles who do enter the church but do not come clothed in righteousness. Matthew obviously wanted very much to make this statement about people being in the church who didn't really belong in the church, because he makes a point of saying that the king invited both good and bad people to the banquet. In this case, however, it really changes the story. To begin with, it's hard to imagine a loving God angrily throwing a guest into the outer darkness where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth. But in this case, even worse is the fact that that guest had just been dragged in off the street. He could hardly have been expected to be wearing a wedding garment. When we pan back and look at how Matthew positioned this particular story in his gospel, it helps us understand the point he was attempting to make with his additions to the story. This entire section of Matthew's gospel deals with those who reject the authority of Jesus. Several stories appear just before this wedding banquet story. First, the religious authorities confront Jesus directly, asking him by whose authority he is teaching. Then comes a parable of two sons. This is the one where a father tells his two sons to go work in his vineyard, and one son says, "Sure, I'll go," but doesn't. And the other son says, "I will not go work in the vineyard," but ends up changing his mind and working in the vineyard. The point being that what one does is more important than what one says. Next comes the parable of the wicked tenants, in which a landowner plants a vineyard and leases it to some tenants. The landowner later sends his slaves to collect the produce, and they're beaten. After a while, he sends his son to collect, and the tenants kill his son. Another straightforward allegory pointing to the fact that Jesus is sent by God, and those who reject his authority must answer to God. Then comes this parable of the wedding banquet we're discussing this morning. And the additions Matthew makes to the story, clearly, are to emphasize that the gospel message of Jesus is the true word of God and should be accepted by everybody. Further, those who accept the message must do more than pay it lip service. They must enter the banquet properly clothed, that is, acting according to the teachings of Jesus. The original story, at least as revealed in the Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Thomas, did not involve a king or a son or a wedding. The story, in summary, goes like this. A man invited many guests to a great banquet, but they told the man's slave that they could not come and made a variety of excuses. So the man told his slave to go out into the streets and invite everybody to the banquet. That is the basic story. And scholars generally believe that Jesus of Nazareth told that story. They do not believe that Jesus' story had the man who symbolizes God throwing people into the outer darkness to painfully suffer. That is Matthew speaking, and not Jesus. This is why I believe Bible scholarship is so important, because once we strip away Matthew's political commentary on the early world of Christianity, we're left with a story that we can be relatively certain Jesus actually told. So we should probably ask ourselves what this story says to us. What does this story tell us about God, about people, about the world? The first thing the story says to me is we're being invited to something, all of us, and that it is God who is extending the invitation. Beyond that, it seems clear that God is not going to force our hand on this thing. We can say no to the invitation. But what are we being invited to? It seems to me that we are being invited to live our lives in the presence of God. That is what the banquet is, life lived in God's presence. We're being invited to live in this world in a whole new way. And if we believe we are being extended an invitation, we must respond. Karl Rahner, a 20th century theologian I have come to regard as one of the greatest theologians in the history of the church, said that the very nature of our lives is a response to that question. We are all forced by the very nature of living in this world as human beings to say either yes or no to God. For Rahner, that's what it means to be a human being. This offer God is making us, for us to live a life in God's presence may sound like, in the words of the old Godfather movies, an offer we can't refuse. You think it's hard saying no to Marlon Brando? Try saying no to God. But the fact is, most people do indeed say no to God. Or like that son in the parable of the father who asked his two sons to go work in his vineyard, their words say yes, but their lives say no. There are lots of excuses for saying no, or more likely for pretending not to hear the question. Among the stories of Matthew, Luke, and Thomas, we discover these reasons for not attending the banquet. One had no time because he had just bought a house. One had to go tend to his farm. One had to go take care of his business. One had to go examine a field he had just purchased. One had to go examine some oxen he had just bought. One had to go collect some money from some merchants. One had to go collect rent. One had to go to the wedding of a friend. One had just gotten married himself. All great excuses. In the world today, our excuses sound much the same. I mean, to live in the presence of God, to invite God into our lives and to try to live our lives the way God wants us to just isn't very practical. Some would say, sure, in principle, we would love to live our lives like that, but we've got to survive, right? As good old Norm said on one of my favorite episodes of Cheers, it's a dog-eat-dog world, and I feel like I'm wearing milk-bone underwear. And all that Sermon on the Mount stuff, that sounds great on paper, but let's do a wake-up call here. You can start out trying your best to live your life in a do-unto-others-as-you-would-have-them-do-unto-you way, but if you want to survive and prosper, your best bet is to do unto others before they do unto you. It's not that people are bad, just practical, pragmatic. I guess God's question, or God's invitation to the banquet, brings up two questions we have to ask ourselves. What would life be like if we say yes, and what is at stake if we say no? If we say yes, if we invite God into our lives unconditionally, then life becomes a banquet. Life itself becomes a celebration, and everything changes. That morning walk we take to try to keep our heart and lungs in proper working order changes. It's no longer the drudgery of traversing the same old route while occasionally stopping to see if our heart rate has reached its optimal speed. It is the glory of having a body that can move across the good earth, of being alive in a radically mysterious universe in which the beating of our hearts is an impossible gift, and a power beyond our knowing draws life into our lungs. It's that incomprehensible rotation of the earth as it hurtles through space, keeping time with the sun and the planets to create a sunrise that starts a symphony of music composed by nature and humanity, music that drifts through the air and dances into our ears. That is a morning walk in the presence of God. That is a morning walk once we've said yes to the invitation to the banquet. That casual conversation we have with a loved one changes. This is no longer idle chatter used to fill up the spaces between television shows. This is a miracle beyond expression that you and I, living spirits in human bodies, can make observations, formulate ideas, and then give them expression, can actually bring into being words, can use the breath in our lungs to vibrate the chords in our throat to make sounds that float through the air and resonate within the ear of another living spirit, and be understood. It is absolutely amazing. In an unimaginably vast universe, in the midst of countless billions of galaxies with countless billions of stars, we can communicate one spirit to another while hurtling through space on this beautiful, tiny speck of dust we call the Earth. That is conversation in the presence of God. That is conversation once we've said yes to the invitation to the banquet. And eating. Well, eating is something different altogether once we invite God into our lives. That apple we just woofed down may stave off hunger for a little while, but there's so much more to the story. Over hundreds of millions, even billions of years, vegetation grew, mutated, evolved, until at some very recent time, perhaps just a few million years ago, apple trees appeared in God's cosmic plan. And then perhaps 30 or so years ago, a seed was planted by some farmer, which eventually grew into a tree thanks to his steady watering, fertilizing, and a healthy dose of God's sunlight. And that tree bore fruit year after year. And then, just a week or so ago, Our apple was picked from that tree and washed, crated, driven to the market where we purchased it from the grocer's display. And when we bite into that apple, it is perfect. Millions of years ago, when both we and that apple were no more than a dream in the imagination of God, the course was set for the day we would see, taste, feel, smell, hear that apple as it becomes a part of us, nourishes us, promises to sustain us. That is eating in the presence of God. That is eating once we've said yes to the invitation to the banquet. The fact is, if you say yes, everything changes. And some people will think you're crazy. You'll be driving down Rock Road, and somebody will rush up on you from behind, even though you're already exceeding the speed limit and holding your place in the flow of traffic, and he'll become absolutely irate at you for having the nerve to exist on the same planet he does. And you'll try to give him the benefit of the doubt. You'll tell yourself that perhaps he's a research scientist who just came up with a cure for some rare disease, and he's rushing to the lab before he loses his inspiration. But then you'll realize most research scientists don't drive pickup trucks with stickers on the windows that say, "Marilyn Manson rules," or "They can take my gun when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers," or my personal favorite, "My wife, yes. My dog, maybe. My gun, never." Kind of makes you feel warm and fuzzy all over, doesn't it? And when they pull up beside you and offer you their single-digit salute, you just look at them and say, "Don't you know you've been invited to a banquet?" They know. They do know. They've just given the wrong answer. I said we have two questions to deal with. The first question was, what would life be like if we say yes to God's invitation to the banquet? But we still have another question to deal with, a question whose answer is considerably shorter than the first. The remaining question is this: what is at stake if we say no to the invitation? And the answer, everything.